Hello, I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, my guest today has been described as the Lord of UK TV, and he certainly has the CV to match. Lord Michael Grade is the television executive who has made his mark on British television in an industry career that spans almost 50 years. From a role as deputy controller at London Weekend Television, he took the reins at the BBC on two occasions as both its controller and chairman respectively, as well as 10 years as CEO of Channel 4 and executive chairman of ITV. And along the way, he commissioned EastEnders, he poached the Brucey from the BBC, and in so doing, built a reputation for getting the job he wants done. Inspired at a young age by his showbiz family, today the show very much goes on, most recently providing his expertise to a government panel on the future of public service broadcasting. And his tip for life is simply this: just be nice to everyone. Lord Grade, welcome to Changemakers. Let's be nice to each other in this interview. Absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Fine, you can say anything you like about somebody to somebody, as long as you say it nicely.
Yeah, that's your tip. You've received many tips along the way, Michael. Your biggest inspiration, your dad and his two brothers, and you said of it, work ethic, honourable. I could go on and on. I think we should go on and on a little bit because of that family. Let's talk about the world of Lou Grade, Baron Grade, the dancer with the humorous feet, the sort of this extraordinary family that you grew up in. What was it like?
I was very, very lucky. I basically had three fathers, my father and his two brothers. My father's mother, my grandmother, came over from persecution in the Ukraine in about 1910, 1911 with her husband. And with two kids, Lord Grade of Elstree and Lord Delfond of Stepney. And they settled in the Jewish ghetto in the East End. They had two more children. My grandfather died. There was no money, nothing. My grandmother brought up four children. She had a daughter as well. Brought up four children with no healthcare, no welfare. Just the only thing that was free was education. Mm-hmm. And she instilled a work ethic into the boys. And they started... Bernie and Lou had dancing acts each on the music hall stage, but soon realized that wasn't a long-term career, and they became agents, and my dad followed them. He never went on the stage, but they became agents, they became producers, West End producers all over the UK. Then my uncle and Lou and my father were partners in the creation of ITV. Mm. In 1955. So that's kind of the family history.
I mean, I always think that if we were doing a modern musical of your life, it would be the kind of British version of The Greatest Showman. I mean, you know, there is a kind of entertainment that goes right the way through your story. Where does it come from? I mean, how does the family get from, as you say, escaping persecution to being one of the most successful media families in the country?
That's a real, I don't think there's any answer to that. I think what drove them was they didn't like poverty. They didn't like having to struggle and what they'd had to struggle with. And they were determined through work to move on. And one of the few sectors that's open to people with little education, I mean, they went to school, they went to state school, and got their education, which was okay, but you wouldn't be too excited about their educational and academic qualifications. They went into a sector that was open to anybody, A, being Jewish, so there were certain sectors that were closed in those days to Jewish people. And the entertainment, you know, it's what we'd call today social mobility. And they found they had a bent for it. They had a taste for it.
And I read an interview with you actually with the Jewish Chronicle where you talked about how much you'd loved everything you've done, and because you'd always achieve what you set out to do, this idea that actually you have very strong goals, you're very driven. I mean, that drove the Evening Standard to say that you make your stellar career sound like one long effortless breeze. But what was it, hard work, or did you just love it and therefore it just seemed to fall into place?
I took the view very early on that if you want to progress, it's no good keep thinking about what am I going to do next. That's the biggest waste of time in the world. I've seen so many careers falter with quite bright individuals who are so worried about their next move but they forget to do today's job.
Right.
And I came to a very early conclusion, which is the only thing I knew because of the family background, was that if you've got a job and you do it as well as you possibly can and you're good at it and you have some success, somebody will come along and spot you and say, why don't you, you know, if you score, if you're in Division One or the Championship and you start scoring a lot of goals, you know, Manchester United and Liverpool are going to come and have a look at you, you know.
I'm glad he didn't stretch the metaphor by mentioning Charlton Athletic, but maybe we can come back to that later on as your club. But is that the kind of the idea that then that, that you know when they say that saying that life is what happens when you're busy making plans? I mean, is that what happens in a lot of people's careers? They're not keeping an eye on the prize.
Do the job better than anybody else around you or in your sector, and things will happen. People will spot you. You know people are always looking for talent. Mm. And simply sitting there plotting your next eight career moves is absolutely destined to keep you exactly at the level you start.
So you don't buy into all of this, plot your career on the back of a menu or a fag packet or...
I had no idea I was going into television.
Really? I mean, because, well, let's get back, because obviously you started with the Daily Mirror. I mean, that was where you cut your teeth in terms of this news journalism world. I mean,
I left school at 17. I didn't want to go into the family business, which was, you know, booming at the time. And my dad knew I was passionate about sport. And the Daily Mirror group were big shareholders in ATV, and they all knew each other. And he got me a £10 a week job. Training as a sports journalist at the Daily Mirror, which I did for 6 years until he was very ill, and then I had to move into the business. But at that point, there was a good reason to move into the business. Mm. But that was a fantastic education, learning about journalism and how newspapers work. That's helped me a great deal in my career.
And presumably, this is like Fleet Street at its finest in terms of the print presses and the hum of the noise and the people and everything.
If I tell you that when I left the Daily Mirror in 1966, the paper was selling 5.25 million every day, that will give you some idea.
I think they'd like that circulation now.
Well, they'd like half of it.
I mean, but it sort of, I mean, ultimately TV became the destination and where... I guess you made your reputation, made your career. I mean, with everything you've just said about career plans in mind, I mean, did TV always attract, though? I mean, was there a...
I was brought up in the variety theatre, really. And the basis of the talent agency that I was part of when I left the Daily Mirror, which is where I learned the business, we were talent agents. And most of that was variety and vaudeville. And over my 6 or 7 years doing that, I came to realize that the variety theatre really wasn't the future. Didn't take a genius to see that. But I got more and more involved with clients who worked in television, directors, writers, producers, and so on, and started to have ideas for television shows and started to sell them. And London Weekend said to me, well, save yourself the taxi fare, come and work for us, which I jumped at.
I mean, if you were starting your career again today with everything that's happened to television and you know, the rise of Netflix, the rise of Amazon, pay TV, all the rest of it, what would you make of the industry? Would you still say it's a place for an ambitious mind to thrive? Or is it actually one of those sorts of parts of the world where actually, there's quite a bit of pain to come, especially for the established sort of terrestrial television stations?
Well, it's a business. Whilst some of it is in decline, the old linear broadcast television is in very slow decline. It's not rapid decline. The business is expanding like mad. I mean, how many channels have you got on Freeview or Sky? How many streaming services are there? They all need content. And that's what drives it. And so it is a great business to come into.
So you might have been a more entrepreneurial version of yourself, because, I mean, you did all the established greats in the BBC, ITV, Channel 4. I mean, I'm just thinking, if we were looking at a Michael Grade in 2021 at 21, would you be setting up and starting up, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I rather, as an agent, you're a salesman. You're selling. Trying to sell your clients to people who don't want them, basically, is what the job is. I rather like being a buyer when I move to television, to be the person that says, yes, we're going to do that. No, we're not going to do that for whatever reason. I like being a buyer. And I was a salesman in Hollywood for a number of years, working in a big production company in Hollywood. And that was a selling job all day long. You're just out pitching. I like buying.
You like buying. I mean, in terms of your experience, where was it easiest to buy in terms of your the stations that you had oversight of? Where could your creative flair and gut instinct, where did it find its most sort of natural home?
Everywhere is the same, really. I wouldn't distinguish between them. The key thing as a buyer was really to be a good judge of the people who are going to execute the idea. You know, who the producer is, who the writer is, who the star is, who the director is. You know, having a really developed sense of who you would trust to buy an idea from. And that's true whether you're in ITV, the BBC, or indeed when I was at Channel 4.
But I suppose judgment is so important. I mean, I can imagine, you know, somebody pitching you EastEnders going, we've got this show about the East End. It's going to be great. You're going to run it every night. You know, I mean, I'm just sort of thinking, what's the sign? What's the signal that you've got a winner? Do you think, is it luck and serendipity, or is there an art to this?
You absolutely do not ever know whether something's going to be a success. What you're paid to know, and you absolutely must know, is what has got absolutely no chance whatsoever of success. And if you can weed those out when you're deciding, then the chances of you having a sort of 51% success rate is much higher. But you've got to know what's got no chance whatsoever of working.
Is there one that got away? Is there one that you think, I missed that, I should have had it?
Well, the show I missed was actually an American buy. We used to go to Hollywood once or twice a year, see all the pilots and decide which shows we wanted to buy. The one I remember with some huge amount of embarrassment was sitting in a screening room in Hollywood watching all the pilots with my colleagues, and up came this show. We watched the whole thing through for an hour, and we all looked at each other and said, this will never work. We don't want to touch it. Let's move on. And that was The X-Files, which was a bit of a miss.
That probably was quite a big miss. I mean, I wonder, is science fiction your thing? Because you're not a great fan of Doctor Who either, which I must say my guest of just this week as we record is Mark Gatiss, obviously the actor who writes and loves Doctor Who. For you, you even put it in Room 101 back in 2002. What's the problem?
I have a blind spot about science fiction, with the exception of E.T. and Close Encounters. I really have a problem with science fiction. But when I was the controller of BBC One, Doctor Who was running, and the producer came to see me to talk about next year, and he said, how many episodes of Doctor Who do you want? I said, well, before I answer that question, I said, have you been to the movies lately? He said, what do you mean? I said, have you seen Star Wars? Have you seen E.T.? Have you seen Close Encounters? He said, yes, of course. I said, I've got news for you. So's your audience. I said, and what you're serving up at the moment, I said, is risible, and I'm not going to do any more. And he was shocked. He thought, you know, that
it was the wobbly sets and
it was a joke. What they've done with it recently, with the revival, they've given it some filmic and special effects qualities, which lifted a bit. But I still think it's a lot of hope.
I'm actually really pleased that on this show that science fiction has turned out to be a bit of a lightning rod category, because in my own household, my wife and I will often differ on this issue because I love science fiction. I love the escapism, the creativity. She much prefers more of the kind of murder mysteries or whatever. So I usually have to sort of repitch science fiction as having some sort of basis in reality. So I'm glad to know. I'm glad to know it's not just me that has this sort of like culture war over the genre.
There is a great danger, as when you've got that much power, you've got all the airtime and all the money to make the programs at your fingertips, and it's kind of the buck stops with you. You have to be very, very careful about your own prejudices and your own likes and dislikes. With the one show at Channel 4, which I commissioned a pilot because the head of comedy was excited about it, and he came in very excited and gave me the pilot to watch. And I thought it was the biggest load of rubbish I'd ever seen. I was mindless, stupid, idiotic, insulting to the audience, half an hour, and that was Father Ted. but I give myself credit for not, he was so enthusiastic about it, so committed to it, I let him do it. I didn't exercise my own restraint on it.
And so how do you check yourself in that? Do you have a technique? Because, you know, I know that there've been other shows, Blackadder and others, that you've...
Blackadder's a different story, but you have to be aware that you don't have a monopoly of taste.
Right.
You have to know that. Blackadder, I'm accused of cancelling Blackadder. I didn't cancel Blackadder. The first series of Blackadder was shot on single camera film up on the mountain in the hills of Wales somewhere. And the producer came to see me about next year again. He said, how many Blackadders do you have? I said, I don't want any. He said, what are you talking about? I said, I don't want any. I said, if you bring it into the studio with an audience and you find out what is and isn't funny, I'll do as many as you like. I said, but I'm not spending any more money on you running around trying to create single camera comedy on a BBC budget. It doesn't work. Bring it into the studio with an audience. I'll do as many as you like. And given their credit, they did. And the rest is history.
And save them from themselves, I read, that actually improved the scripting and the writing.
No question. No question. You know, when you shoot comedy on film, single camera film, you don't shoot it in order. You've got no audience. You don't know what's funny, what isn't funny. You do it in front of a studio audience. Boy, you find out what you've got.
Now, we mentioned, the changes that have been going on in TV in terms of the changes of opportunities to watch in lots of so many different ways. And of course, standing within that mix is the BBC. In August of last year, you talked about them being out of touch with the rest of the country, particularly as it pertained to Brexit. Do you think things have changed in the pandemic, or do you think your view of the BBC remains intact?
Well, there's two BBCs. There's BBC journalism, which is a whole topic on its own. Then there's BBC programme making of a general type, which is the rest of the BBC. And it's the journalism that where I have the problem sometimes, not always, but sometimes. I think they've been caught napping on a number of occasions. BBC journalism completely missed the Thatcher revolution in the 80s, completely missed it. They completely missed Brexit. They didn't understand that the country was so narrowly divided on the Brexit question. I thought that the journalism was very shoddy at times. They keep wheeling in experts to offer their opinion, which is fine. I have no problem with that. But they never asked the experts which side of the argument they were on, and people select the arguments that suit their point of view. I'll declare mine. I voted eventually. I wasn't a fanatical Brexiteer, but I did vote for Brexit in the end on the issue of sovereignty. But when it came to the last election, where Boris got an 80-odd seat majority, you could feel the sharp intake of breath at the BBC, who never saw it coming. Because they weren't in touch with the grassroots, you know, with the red wall, the blue wall. They're just completely out of touch.
What about the pandemic?
My problem with their coverage of the pandemic is that the journalism at the beginning, particularly in the early press conferences, was extremely aggressive. Completely gotcha. You said 2 weeks ago there would be 129 this and two. Now it's only 105. It was all got. There was no sense of an understanding of just how complex and difficult this was. Now it's perfectly proper for the BBC to be questioning the government on all of its policies, etc., etc. But to do it from a position of aggressive questioning and trying to catch them out on it is childish. It adds to no one's understanding. And what we've got at the moment is wall-to-wall problems. I've yet to hear any interviewer say, well, that's the problem. What is the solution? What do you think? Anybody can go on TV and point to all the problems. We know what the problems are.
But with all of that frustration, you'd still keep the license fee?
Not necessarily. I would support the license fee absent. You've got to spool back. What's the BBC for? What do you want it to do? Then you work out how to pay for it and how, how, how it should be delivered. So I'm at the moment, we're in the early days of this review of public service broadcasting, this group with the government. At the moment, I'm agnostic. I'm open to a suggestion that is better than the license fee. But you've got to first work out what it is you want to deliver and then work out how to pay for it.
And what do you make of the arrival of News UK as a new channel, which some are branding as a potential UK version of Fox News? Does that add to the mix, or does that worry you? I mean, especially when you think about, you know, speaking truth unto nations, peace unto nations. I mean, is that the complete counter opposite of that?
The only reason we have impartiality rules in the media in this country is that media was a very media spectrum on which to broadcast was a very limited resource. And it belongs to the people, it belongs to the nation. And if you want to use those resources, you're in a very, very powerful position. And therefore, you shouldn't be like a newspaper owner using the public's airwaves in order to push your point of view of the world. That has changed now. There is no, you know, you and I could start a television station tomorrow and get access. There's no barrier to entry today like there used to be. I'm totally in favor of having partial news, as long as at the core you have got some competition, BBC, ITV, Channel 4, whatever, with impartial news, as long as there's a bedrock.
We are talking today on, today's the day of the inauguration of a new US president, Joe Biden. The White House and the Capitol is currently completely zoned off like a war zone. A lot of people will say, well, this is partially because we're living in a world of peak Fox News influence in terms of just the level of, you know, visceral debate or visceral accusation, and that it is precisely the problem that in a way there is no control. I mean, do you accept that at all? I mean, David Dimbleby did a very good series on the, which he called The Sun King, the rise of the kind of Murdoch empire, of which I thought the most interesting thing was just how much influence Fox News gave compared to the newspapers. I mean, these are super weapons, these stations, are they not?
Yes, but there is a much bigger question behind this. Fox News would not be a success unless it was tapping into a real feeling in the American electorate. And we've seen that played out over the last 4 years and in the last few weeks in Washington. There is a clear sense that the political establishment, why was Trump elected? Trump was elected because he wasn't an establishment political figure. And the electorate is saying to Washington, you know, you guys are out of touch. You don't know anything about our lives. You know, you're all on this kind of woke, elitist, liberal kick. But that ain't putting food on my kid's table. And that's not getting me a job. And the whole thing is a manifestation, in my view. Could have the same thing here very easily, is a manifestation of a disenchantment and a feeling by the electorate that the politicians have lost touch with them.
So that's a very different view about what a new station does in terms of providing a voice rather than providing information.
Why do you read the Daily Mail or the Guardian? You read it because it has the same view of the world as you do. And in American television, there was no news that reflected the kind of worldview of a heck of a lot of people in America, and Fox gave them a voice.
What do you make of Donald Trump's ban on Twitter?
This is, I'm not sure I know what the answer is here. One, it's quite clear that the Twitters and the Facebooks and so on have got to take some responsibility for what they publish. That's not to say that they are publishers. They're somewhere between a common carrier, like a telephone, and a publisher. They're somewhere in between. There is a definition of these people which will create some form of regulation. The first thing I would do, I would expect them or require them never to publish anything anonymously. They need, I don't even mind if they would, if I write something and I say to Twitter, I'm Michael Grade, but I don't want you to publish my name, but I'm giving you my name. This is the source of this tweet. I think that would go some way to sorting it out.
Do you think the horse has bolted though with organizations like Twitter? Do you think that they are reformable in terms of the way that they
have to be regulated? They have to be regulated. It's finding the right balance between censorship, which we don't want, and responsibility. Let's not forget, however, that there are laws in this country about incitement, incitement to an affray and race hate and so on. And so the law is there to be pursued. If I make some violently anti-Semitic tweet, that's race hate. I can be prosecuted and I should be prosecuted. So it doesn't always only fall on the platform.
Do you think, if you were taking one of those big jobs again, I mean, it sounds to me like along the way you had a lot of fun with what you were doing. We had Rory Bremner as a guest. He was regaling us with the story of him phoning up the cabinet, impersonating John Major and actually persuading them that he was, and that you had to be called in. In terms of where you sit today, looking at a career in television, do you think it'd be as much fun for you if you were doing it all again? Do you think you could be as irreverent and as sort of boundary pushing as you were back?
Oh yes. There's nothing to stop you. It's high risk, and the market outside of the BBC, where there's competition for revenue, whether it's subscriptions or advertising, or whatever, the competition is fierce. And that tends to be a damper on taking high risks. And that's my big worry is the element of risk. That's sort of where that's one of the roles of the BBC.
I was going to say the risk culture. I mean, I noted you're watching Billions during the lockdown. I mean, a show about risk entirely. I mean, is that what you want to see in television?
No, it's not a show about risk. Let's take a recent example. If you're a very commercial advertiser supported or subscription supported company, would you have taken a chance with an unknown Phoebe Waller-Bridge and done Fleabag and taken a chance on that? I don't think so. You'd wait for someone else to take the risk and then you try and buy her. You know, that's kind of how the market works. So it's risk that I built my career on taking huge risks. I mean, one of the biggest risks we ever took was a thing called The Big Breakfast, which everybody said to me afterwards, oh, you've just gone commercial, Mike. I said, it didn't feel like being commercial, you know, when we took the £12 million risk on commissioning that show out in the house in the East End. You know, it didn't feel like a commercial certainty, but I knew it had a chance.
Michael Grade, Lord Grade, thank you very much for joining me on Changemakers. And I think, you know, what a great way to finish it, talking about those stories, about the risks you take in life. And I think being nice to everyone along the way. And it's been a story of making it until you make some more, never compromising on values and always striving to achieve goals. I think that's given Michael the taste for television that does make this country tick. He's picked plenty of winners along that journey. And for more of those unafraid to make their voices heard, do join me next time on the next Changemakers.